Well, I hope I can add a bit of evidence of why this really is a wicked problem. But first, I want to say something about the scientific method. Essentially, the method is that if you have a theory or a model, the more you make valid predictions, the more confidence you have in that model. But some of your predictions fail, you've got to look very carefully at that model, revise it, and be particularly wary of predictions that aren't able to check. Secondly, consensus is not relevant. Oh, let me get to... Yes. I need to move the slides on. Very interesting example of those two Australian doctors. Before 1982, the consensus was that peptic ulcers were caused by anxiety, and there was no cure for them. They questioned that. They thought it might be a bacterium. In fact, Barry Marshall went so far as to actually infect himself. We now know it is a bacterium, and there's a cure. So here's the story of all those absorbing gases. The important point is that water vapor is really the one that matters. And carbon dioxide, the others, if that adds a little bit of extra heating, the water... The atmosphere will hold a little bit more water vapor, which then could increase the heating, and so a positive feedback. But that extra water vapor in the atmosphere also creates more clouds. Some clouds are reflective, some clouds are absorbing. So the net effect is not certain. Whether the net effect is positive or negative feedback, I think we don't know. So one of the ways around that is to make these very complicated climate models. But the problem is limited by the speed of your very best computers. And so that if you're going to do the whole Earth and layers of the atmosphere and layers of the ocean, the grid size on the Earth is perhaps 100 or 200 kilometers on a side. And so the many crucial atmospheric effects are too small, particularly thunderstorms and those clouds that you really don't fully understand. So the climate models get around this by parameterizing these things that they can't put the proper physics in. And then you have to adjust, they call it tune the parameters to make the model sensible. But there's... It's not a unique set of parameters. So, already reasons to be somewhat uncertain about what these models are telling us. But it's more serious than that. And here's a recent paper by some of the leading climatologists, people who are concerned about what the climate is going to do. But what they're telling us is that the recent set of models, which were supposed to be significant improvement in many of the features, particularly clouds, many other things, they're running too hot. That many of the models in this whole set are unduly hot. And the difficulty is that people trying to make predictions of what's going to happen in the future of these have taken the whole range, including the excessively hot ones, so they're getting a biased prediction. And they're trying to call attention to this, that there are papers out there already. And there's a second problem. The Intergovernmental Panel has put out several scenarios of what future emissions might be. And people, some of which are really unduly pessimistic. The extreme one is 6.5 times increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But again, you know, if you're writing a paper and it would be nice to get some media attention, well, let's take the worst case. And so again, people have taken some of those worst case scenarios, and they're out in the literature too. So you have to be careful about just how to trust those papers. Okay. Now here's an interesting test of the models. The tropical rainfall. The picture on the left is one of the latest models, the prediction of the tropical rainfall, two bands on either side of the equator. The observations are a single band. Now, we also hear about how terrible the rising seas and the glaciers in Greenland are melting and will melt more as the carbon dioxide is increasing in the atmosphere. But if you take sea level with a tide gauge, here's one going back to 1850. And if you take it a place like this Baltic Sea port that isn't perturbed by changes in ocean currents, a wonderfully linear change in sea level. Whereas carbon dioxide became important, maybe 1965, no effect whatsoever on the sea level. And unfortunately, we hear a lot about those atolls in the Indian and Pacific Oceans that are going to get drowned by this suddenly rising sea level. Well, there's no evidence that these atolls are shrinking. In fact, the evidence where exists is that if anything, they're gaining a little bit of land. They're not going to be drowned. And in fact, Charles Darwin on his round the world voyage was very puzzled. Coincidence. How is it that all of these little islands are just a few meters above sea level? And he concluded that the coral process that makes those atolls rises with the rising sea. In fact, I think the real problem with some of those atolls is their business model of tourism. Is that I think is going to be a more serious damage to any atoll. Well, let's go on. Different topic. Forest fires in Canada. They've been very serious this last summer, and some of them are still burning. But there's no evidence that this is getting any worse. There's the statistical evidence. I'm sure there's going to be a big bar for this coming year, for this current year, but it doesn't show that there's any gradual worsening of the forest fires. Similarly, in the United States, we hear about heat waves. But look, the real heat waves were back in the 1930s. And beware, if you just plot the recent ones, looks like there might be a problem, but you've really got to see the whole picture. Here's a particular one. We hear that every time there's a heat wave in country X, how terrible it is, people are dying, and that's very serious. But it's the cold weather that really is killing people, and that's not just northern countries, that's tropical countries as well. That even in India, it's the cold that kills people far more than the heat. Now, here's the temperature curve that we hear so much about. And there, after about 1960, 70 in that, you can see the rising temperature that's attributed to carbon dioxide. But look, what's that from about 1910 to 1940? The temperature was going up at the same rate as it is now. But there was, carbon dioxide wasn't a serious contributor then. And then for another 40 years, the temperature went down. So there's some other things contributing to the global temperatures. I'm not sure, we don't know what they are, but to say, as the many people do, that present curve is entirely due to absorbing gases seems to be a pretty invalid assumption. And in fact, let's look a little bit at climate history. We certainly are now warming up after the little ice age, and if you read about the challenges that had in many parts of Northern Europe, I think we should be very grateful that we are warming up since the little ice age. And it isn't a local thing. There's evidence that in the Southern Hemisphere, the Little Ice Age was present there also. then we had a medieval warm period, a period when it was comparable to temperatures that we're having now. And that's when the Norse settled Greenland and had productive farms. But then when the Little Ice Age came, they had to abandon them. And then there was a Roman warm period. And one of the evidences for that is that there are passes in the Swiss Alps where people that are now thawing, but we're finding Roman artifacts. People crossed those passes 2,000 years ago and lost a few things. Basically then, we've been rather beneficial that the warming that we've had. And so the question is, how much of this present carbon dioxide, present warming is due to carbon dioxide and the other gases, and how much is due to natural effects that we don't necessarily understand and that we certainly cannot control? So, without a quantitative answer, the basic question, should we concentrate on mitigation, stopping the carbon dioxide generation, or should we concentrate on adaptation? In other words, if it's mainly natural effects, adaptation is the only way that's going to help us. Now, so, indeed, we don't know, and I can understand that there's much disagreement in all of this. But let's admit that there is an uncertainty. Reduce emissions where it's practical. And then concentrate on the adaptation, which we'll certainly need. Now, often the approach to all of this is, well, when there's uncertainty, we should adopt the precautionary principle and take the precaution of cutting out the carbon dioxide, the methane, and the others. But if you're doing that, you've got to think, what are your priorities? Well, for me, I think that once we get Russia out of the Ukraine, I think the one that we need to look at is the world population. In my lifetime, the population of the world has quadrupled, and it's still going up. And it's going to be, in the future, it's going to be largely in Africa. I think the challenge will be to feed 10 billion people, and in particular, for many of them, to have enough fresh water. Now, particular challenge, if we want to get energy without fossil fuels, is to realize just how much of present energy is from fossil fuels. In the United States, 79%. Canada, 74%. In my view, the only answer, and the climate activist James Hansen has the same view, it's nuclear power. So, here's my prescription. A major increase in nuclear power. And if we do that, if you talk to power engineers, the challenge from the windmills and the solar is intermittency. And that an intermittent, if your source of power of these intermittent sources is more than 20 or 30%, the grid cannot handle it. And so, if you do make the transition to nuclear power, you can avoid the expense and all the the environmental impact of all those windmills, the batteries, and the solar cells, and all the extra mining that you need to support that. And also, my next suggestion is to avoid those non-zero mandates. Now, that's there because they want to convince people that they really have to make the change. But my challenge is, you've got to convince the government that they've got to let nuclear power plants be built. And so I think you want to reverse that and put the pressure on the governments to let them happen. And similarly, this one about curtailing fertilizers because of the methane or of the nitrous oxide that's generated. But again, why not prove that you can feed that 10 million people without those fertilizers? And the final one, I think, is one where you really can do something. Those extreme weather events are going to happen. If they've happened in the past, the chances are that sometime in the future, you're going to have another one. It's a local thing. Look at what was the extreme problems that you had in your locality. Do something so it isn't so bad next time. Can we stop doing foolish things like building in floodplains, building in forests that might catch fire, draining ocean aquifers that cause landslides, as it does in the state of Virginia. All the selling American trees to England, where it gets burned for electricity. and the killing of the eagles. I understand now that it's up to the windmill operators to report bird kill with their windmills. And the last one, that telling developing countries that they shouldn't use fossil fuels. I think for us Christians, do we go to Africa by airplane, talk about the saving grace of Jesus Christ, and at the same time tell them that they should continue in energy poverty to save the planet? Thank you.
Have you considered climate data further back in time? You only went back to the Roman Empire. You go back 90,000, almost 100,000 years, we had an ice age that covered North America. Sea levels were 300 feet lower than today. And if you go back like 40 million years ago, when carbon dioxide emissions are what they are today, about 400 parts per million, sea levels were 400 feet higher. So you should look at, have you looked at that data?
So the question is looking at data that goes back further than the Roman Empire.
Yeah, I think I...
You got it.
I agree with... I don't know, do I...
You can answer.
No, what exactly what did he...
He said, he's asking if you had looked at data that goes further back
yes.
than the Roman Empire and talking okay. about ice ages.
Very definitely. I think the paleology tells us that we certainly had warm and cold spells and sea of carbon dioxide went up and down, but not in phase. Yes.
Just quickly, you mentioned other causes that would be natural causes. Do you have some in mind? You didn't specify particular natural causes for climate change besides human causes.
So what would be, if climate change isn't being caused by carbon dioxide and is caused by natural causes, what would be the natural causes that are causing it?
What are the natural causes? I wish I knew, but I think it's certainly the historic evidence is that there are things going on we don't yet fully understand.
From an astronomy point of view, there's the Milankovitch cycle, which looks at gradual variations.
There are astronomical effects that affect the Earth's climate, or astronomical causes. There's the Milankovitch effect, which combines three astronomical variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun, its tilt on its axis, which keep varying on certain timescales. And there's a rather good correlation between the Milankovitch cycles and the Earth's temperature over the last several hundred thousand years.
Oh, I'm not sure I got that. No.
Okay, let me say it louder. Can you hear this?
Yeah.
You can. Okay. There are astronomical causes that correlate rather closely with the broad changes in Earth's temperature over the last 400,000 years. It's called the Milankovitch effect.
Oh.
There are three different variations in the Earth's sun system, like the tilt of the Earth's axis, which varies on a 26,000-year cycle. There's the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit varies on a different time scale. But I've seen data where over the last 400,000 years, there's a rather good correlation between the Earth's ocean temperature, judged from ice cores in Antarctica,
yes,
and
that's right. No, you're correct. I should have mentioned the Milankovitch cycles, and indeed, though there are some evidence that it, at some times in the past they didn't match up, but in fact, I'm sure they must be contributing to some extent. Yes.
I just want to say that there's a lot of these natural causes have been well studied, but every single cause that we've looked at in the past that had an effect is actually in the opposite direction. And so most scientists would point out that the human contribution is around 200% of the current change, because the other causes would have resulted in cooling. There are really good websites that address a number of the issues that you raised here that a number of our speakers have also discussed over the years and at this conference. So I think it's important to have to recognize the diversity of views on this topic while still showing respect to those who disagree. But it seems to me that a lot of the information that you presented here has been quite refuted by many organizations, including our members of our own organization. And I know it's not possible to engage in a lengthy discussion on that now, but perhaps over the rest of the conference, such conversations can still happen.
Yeah, we're pretty much out of time, but I don't know how much of that you heard. But he was saying that those natural causes have been studied. The possible ones that have caused climate change in the past, and they are all being found to be causing cooling at the moment. So human-induced climate change is actually 200%.
I wouldn't agree that those ones are all identified and caused cooling. I think that's, I think there's, as I said, caused the temperature in the 1940s to go up.
Well, I think
we can discuss that more later.
Yes, I think we'll have to end it there. So thank you, everyone, for your attention, and to the speakers.